Welcome. My name is Divine. I am a fourth year medical student. In today's episode of the Divine Intervention Podcast, we're going to be talking about immunopharmacology. And in addition to talking about immunopharmacology, we're going to spend some time discussing the monoclonal antibodies that are classically tested on the board exams. We'll begin first by talking about some interleukins and some immunophysiology, and then we'll go from there. So, without further ado, let's get started. So, if we sort of want to have a basis for how many of these, or I guess the functions of many of the interleukins that are classically tested, I think a good starting point is with the pluripotent stem cell that ultimately becomes a source of all our blood cell lines, right? So, if you have a pluripotent stem cell and you expose it to interleukin 7, okay, you can go down the lymphoid lineage. And an easy way to remember that is the L in lymphoid, if you flip that over, okay, becomes a 7. And under the lymphoid lineage, remember we have B and T cells. And the B cells, they express CD19, 20, and 21. Okay, the terminal B cell line, you should hopefully remember that it's the plasma cell, okay? But remember that plasma cells do not express CD20. That's actually very high yield to know for board exams. Now, your T cells, on the other hand, they are generally CD3 positive, okay? And under that, we have the CD4 positive cells and the CD8 positive T cells, okay? For the CD4 positive T cells, those are the helper T cells. They all start as T helper 0 cells. But we can either go down the T helper 1 route, which is more involved in cell mediated immunity, or the T helper 2 route, which is more involved in antibody mediated immunity. If you want to go down the T helper 1 route, you go from T helper 0 with interleukin 12. If you want to go down the IL-4 route, okay? If you want to go down the T helper 2 route from T helper 0, you go down that pathway with interleukin 4. Okay, remember that 2 squared is 4. So interleukin 4, T helper 2, those numbers sort of go together. Now, you should also remember that interleukin 2 is a T cell stimulating factor. Okay, so by giving interleukin 2, you can actually increase the rate of progression of a T cell from the G phase to the S phase. Now, try to remember this mnemonic. It's something you hear about pretty commonly as you study for step one, okay, on the different functions of certain high yield interleukins. It's the hot T-bone steak mnemonic, okay? So hot T, bone, being bone, and then EAK in steak. Okay, so interleukin 1 is a pyrogen, okay, that's the hot. Interleukin 2 is a T cell stimulator, that's the T in T-bone, okay. Interleukin 3 is a bone marrow stimulator, okay, so kind of like GM-CSF, if you may, that's the being bone, okay. Interleukin 4 helps you class switch to IgG and IgE, okay, and it also helps you go down the T-helper 2 lineage, okay, so that's the E in steak. Interleukin 5 helps you class switch to IgA, okay, and it also helps you proliferate eosinophils. So that's the A in steak. And then the K in steak is for interleukin 6. It's an acute, right? So instead of a C, you think of a K. It's an acute phase reactant, okay? It's a pyrogen. Your T helper 1 cells, they actually release interferon gamma, right? Which we know is like the stimulating factor for macrophages. Okay, and then just like we have CD4 positive cells that are more for antibody mediated immunity, we have CD8 positive cells that are for cell mediated or cytotoxic immunity. Although the CD4 positive cells, the T helper 1 subset, are also primarily involved in sprucing up cell mediated immunity. So we also have the natural killer cells. Remember, they're a kind of lymphocyte, but they're more under the purview of the innate immune system as against the adaptive immune system. And it's very high yield to know that they are CD16 and 56 positive. Okay, CD56 is actually the receptor for IgG. Okay, I believe I alluded to this at a previous podcast where I was not sure. So now I'm sure. Okay, CD56 is in fact a receptor for IgG. Okay, it's known as the Fc gamma receptor. Basically, the constant region of IgG can dock to this receptor. Okay, and when the constant region of IgG docks to this receptor, the natural killer cell, if the antibody that docks, like let's say the IgG that docks is bound to like a bug or some cell or something, the natural killer cell can release perforin to poke holes in the walls of the attached cell or bug, and then granzyme B can go in and activate the apoptosis cascade. Okay, so you can get cell killing. This process is known as antibody dependent cellular cytotoxicity, which is actually kind of high yield to know for step one. Okay, and remember that ADCC may sound a lot like opsonization, but they're actually different processes. Okay, in opsonization, yes, IgG can do that, just like IgM. Okay, IgG can do opsonization. IgM cannot do opsonization. The only like function that is shared by IgG and IgM is that they can both activate the classic complement cascade. But IgG, if it coats an organism, and then a macrophage comes and swallows up the IgG and the organism whole as one in the process of phagocytosis, that will be opsonization. Okay, but if a natural killer cell, for example, binds to the concentration of IgG that's bound to some bug or some cell, and then releases factors that cause the death or destruction of that bug or that cell, that will be antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity. So that's it for the lymphoid lineage. Okay, the myeloid lineage in general. If you expose your bone marrow to GCSF, right, so granulocyte colony stimulating factor, that helps you make a ton of granulocytes, right? And the easy way to remember your granulocytes is with the mnemonic BEN. I don't know if any of the podcast listeners has the name BEN, but that stands for basophils, eosinophils, and neutrophils. Okay, remember, neutrophils are the most common myeloid cell that you should find in the blood. Very decent mnemonic for that is never let monkeys eat bananas, right? So never is neutrophils, okay? Let, that's lymphocytes, monkeys, that's monocytes, eat, that's eosinophils, bananas, that's basophils. Okay, so that tells you from which should be in the highest concentration amongst your myeloid cells that you find in the blood, and which should be in the lowest concentration. Lowest concentration, basophils. Highest concentration, neutrophils, which are also known as polymorphonuclear leukocytes. So, if your bone marrow is exposed to GM-CSF as against GCSF, right? So, GM-CSF is granulocyte monocyte colony stimulating factor. That helps you make either granulocytes or agranulocytes, right? So, your granulocytes are like your BEN, okay? And then your agranulocytes includes your macrophages, okay? Now, for megakaryocytes, remember that megakaryocytes are the precursors to platelets, okay? In general, if you want to induce a megakaryocyte to go down the platelet pathway, you want to expose your bone marrow to interleukin-11 or thrombopoietin, okay? So thrombopoietin, interleukin-11, these all promote proliferation of platelets. Now, we know that EPO, right, if you expose your bone marrow to EPO, it helps, it makes your bone marrow churn out more red blood cells, because you're basically talking to your erythroid precursors and you're telling them to make more and more red cells. So analogs like erythropoietin and darbepoietin, okay, these are EPO analogs. You can actually use them to treat like anemia of chronic disease or anemia if a person has renal disease. You can give them those analogs to spruce up their bone marrow to begin to make more red blood cells. Now, you should also not forget, as an aside, that there are certain cancers that express EPO as a paraneoplastic phenomenon. Okay, so don't forget your renal cell carcinoma. Okay, don't forget your hepatocellular carcinoma. Okay, remember that has AFP, alpha fetoprotein, as a tumor marker. And then don't forget your brain tumor, the hemangioblastoma. So let's begin to go into a couple of drugs now that we've sort of laid the groundwork for how the immune system works-ish. Okay, the first drug I'll talk about is Oprovacin. Okay, Oprovacin is an interleukin-11 analog. Okay, remember I just said that IL-11 or thrombopoietin helps you proliferate platelets. So if a person has a thrombocytopenia, for example, if they have ITP, immune thrombocytopenic purpura, where you make autoantibodies against GP2B3A, remember that would scrub the aggregation step of primary hemostasis. If you have ITP, you can actually give Oprovacin as a medication for that. although classically ITP is treated with corticosteroids or IVIG, or if it's super severe, you get a splenectomy. So, remembering ITP in general, you don't give platelets, right? Because the antibodies are still around. So whatever platelets you're given, you just have them destroyed peripherally. So it's like not worth it at all. Okay, but Oprovican, which is an IL-11 analog, can be given for ITP. And as a general principle, if something ends in like leukin or vican, those are usually interleukin analogs. Okay, that's why they have those terminal suffixes in their names. Now, the next drug we'll go to is L-thrombopag. Okay, L-thrombopag is a thrombopoietin receptor agonist. Okay, so again, it helps you proliferate platelets. You can also use this in the treatment of ITP. Next drug will be romiplostim. Romiplostim is a thrombopoietin analog. Okay, you can also use it to treat ITP, right? So, one way to think about platelet proliferation is ask yourself, I can either give the interleukin analog, Oprovican, or I can give the thrombopoietin analog, romiplostim, or I can give the thrombopoietin receptor agonist, which is L-thrombopag, okay? And you can use all these things to treat ITP. Now, if a person has chemo-induced neutropenia, right? So let's say they've taken very hardcore chemotherapy and their bone marrows have been severely suppressed and they have neutropenia, you're worried about life-threatening infections. One thing you can do is to give a G-CSF analog like filgrastim or a GM-CSF analog like sagramostim. Okay, these drugs both spruce up the bone marrow to increase your white count, especially your neutrophil count. Now, next drug I'll talk about is rituximab. Rituximab is a monoclonal antibody against CD20. Okay, one high yield mechanism of action you sort of want to keep in mind for your exam is that one of its mechanisms of killing is by promoting ADCC because it's an actual antibody. Okay, so it has a constant region that can bind to certain receptors on the surfaces of macrophages or natural killer cells and ultimately cause cell death. Okay, and because this is a monoclonal against CD20, you can begin to opine that this does not affect plasma cells, right? Because plasma cells, remember, they do not have CD20, okay? Plasma cells are terminal B cells, but they do not express CD20. And as an aside, what's the receptor that's used by EBV to get into B cells? That's CD21, okay? Something for you to remember for step one. Okay, now, next drug I'll talk about is ordesleukin, right? So if it has leukin in the name, that tells you that it's an interleukin analog. Okay, this is an interleukin 2 analog. By being an interleukin 2 analog, it can stimulate T cells. Okay, in fact, you can actually use this drug ordesleukin to treat renal cell carcinoma. Okay, because by giving something that stimulates T cells, you can spruce up your immune system to fight the cancer. And somewhat similar concept is bladder cancer can be treated. Bladder cancer can actually be treated by intravesically giving the BCG vaccine, because when you give the BCG vaccine to the bladder, okay, you basically bring the immune system to come and do like their damage duty on the bladder, and that can actually take care of the cancer as well. Now, next drug I'll talk about is interferon gamma. Okay, remember, interferon gamma is a macrophage stimulator. So if you have any disease where your macrophages are not working right, you could potentially give interferon gamma for that, right? So a classic, two classic examples. One would be CGD, chronic granulomatous disease. Okay, remember, that's where you have an NADPH oxidase deficiency, right? So you cannot deal with catalase positive bugs. You can give interferon gamma as treatment for CGD. Another thing you could also give interferon gamma for is osteopetrosis, right? So that's more of an endocrine disease. It's called a brittle bone disease where your osteoclasts do not work right. So you just lay down bone in an aberrant fashion. And by laying down the bone in the aberrant fashion, one, the person can have pathological fractures, and they could also have pancytopenia. because their bone marrow is not organized right. So one way you can actually treat osteopetrosis, which hopefully remember arises secondary to a carbonic anhydrase 2 deficiency, right? So your osteoclast cannot form that ruffled border and dump in acid to resorb bone, okay? One way you can actually treat osteopetrosis is to give interferon gamma for that, okay? So interferon gamma can be used for macrophage diseases like CGD. Okay, remember macrophages are powerful phagocytes and they're involved in the respiratory bursts. And remember your osteoclasts are a kind of macrophage. Okay, they are they're basically the bone macrophages. Okay, now etanercept is the next drug I'm going to talk about. It's basically a decoy receptor against the TNF-alpha. Okay, it's a TNF-alpha decoy receptor. I will sort of draw your attention as well to denosumab. Denosumab is also an endocrine drug. It's a decoy receptor against the RANK ligand. Okay, against RANK ligand. So just a somewhat similar concept, although it's a different pharmacology. Okay, now, so let's go ahead and jump to the monoclonal alphabet. Okay, basically, in this review, I'm just going to talk about all the monoclonals that tested on step one. Okay, so the first one I'll start with the A. Okay, apsiximab. Okay, apsiximab, and I'm going to go through this rapid fire. Apsiximab, okay, it's a monoclonal antibody against GP2B3A. Okay, remember, by taking this drug, you're basically replicating a similar pathophysiology to immune thrombocytopenia. Okay, remember, that's where you form autoantibodies against GP2B3A. And just as an aside, don't forget your other GP2B3A antagonists, right? So like tirofiban and eptifibatide. Now, next drug in our armamentarium is adalimumab. Okay, adalimumab, you use it primarily to treat autoimmune diseases like Crohn's. Okay, it's a monoclonal antibody against TNF-alpha. Next drug in our arsenal is alirocumab. Okay, alirocumab is a PCSK9 inhibitor, right? So let's talk about what PCSK9 does. PCSK9 basically causes endocytosis and destruction of your LDL receptors. Okay, the thing is, if a person has high cholesterol, you want those people's LDL receptors to persist on the surface of hepatocytes, right? Because if it persists, you'll clear more LDL from the serum. So one way you could potentially treat a person having very high levels of cholesterol, for example, in a familial hypercholesterolemia, if you may, is to inhibit the destructor of LDL receptors, which is PCSK9. So you can give a PCSK9 inhibitor, okay, like alirocumab, okay, like alirocumab. Now, next monoclonal is alemtuzumab. Okay, alemtuzumab is a monoclonal antibody against CD52. It's actually used to treat chronic lymphocytic leukemia, okay, CLL. Remember, CLL on exams, right, doesn't show up in young people. It's an old person, hematologic malignancy. So classically, it shows up in like ladies or guys that are like in their 80s. They have like multiple infections because, yes, they have a very high white count. Usually it's like 80 to 100,000. But those white cells don't work very well. Okay, and remember that on histology in CLL, you'll see smudge cells. Okay, so mature B and T cells, they actually express CD52. So you make a monoclonal antibody against this, and through antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity or other mechanisms of destruction, you can sort of bring down the proliferation of these aberrant lymphoid cells in CLL. So alemtuzumab, CD52 inhibitor, okay, used to treat CLL. Now, we're done with the A's. Let's jump to the B's. Okay, the first B we'll talk about is bevacizumab. Bevacizumab is a monoclonal antibody against VEGF. Okay, remember that in macular degeneration, you have, especially the wet kind, you have an aberrant proliferation of blood vessels, which can opacify the eye and then begin to cause problems, right? Remember, in macular degeneration, you lose central vision first before you lose peripheral vision. You could potentially treat this condition with bevacizumab, which is a VEGF inhibitor. By inhibiting VEGF, you make less and less of the blood vessels that are cloudy, basically like clouding out the eye. Now, the next bee I'll talk about is basiliximab. Basiliximab is a chimeric monoclonal antibody against a part of the interleukin 2 receptor. Okay, but to make things simple, let's just call it part of the interleukin 2 receptor. Let's just call it a monoclonal against the IL-2 receptor. Okay, the IL-2 receptor, the subunit that's specifically inhibited by basiliximab is actually known as CD25. Okay, so remember that IL-2 is a T-cell stimulator. Okay, so by blocking the IL-2 receptor, you're blocking the stimulation of T-cells. So you can use this to basically deplete your T-cell population. And as an aside, one thing I will just say with the interleukin 2 receptor, if you actually have a deficiency of this receptor, especially the gamma subunit, you actually have an increased risk of SCID, okay, so a severe combined immunodeficiency. And also remember, another common cause of SCID is an adenosine deaminase deficiency, right? So that's one common cause of autosomal recessive SCID. I talked about the pathophysiology of SCID from adenosine deaminase deficiency in episode 13 of our podcast. So now we're done with the Bs, okay? Now the Cs, okay? Satralizumab is the first C. It's a TNF-alpha inhibitor. Nothing big there. Next C is cetuximab. So cetuximab is a monoclonal antibody against the epidermal growth factor receptor, EGFR, okay? More specifically, the ERBB1 receptor, ERBB1. So please don't confuse ERBB1 with ERBB2, which is overexpressed in breast cancers, okay, and blocked by drugs like trastuzumab, okay? But ERBB1 is a tyrosine kinase receptor, okay, that's actually overexpressed in lots and lots and lots of colorectal cancers. So if you blocked this epidermal growth factor receptor, you could potentially prevent the proliferation of colorectal cancer cells. Okay, so that's how cetuximab works. Now, one very high yield thing they could test on step one in relation to the epidermal growth factor receptor and cetuximab is how a person does not respond to cetuximab treatment. The thing is, the epidermal growth factor receptor uses KRAS as one of its second messengers. Okay, so if you have an activating mutation in KRAS, even if you're blocking the EGFR receptor, ERBB1, you will not respond to that drug because it's like, oh, regardless, downstream of the receptor, you already have an overactivating mutation. And I'm really hoping that with this extra information I just mentioned, you can sort of tie another concept in here, which is the adenoma carcinoma sequence in colorectal cancer, right? So remember, you classically start with an APC gene mutation, okay? And then you progress to a KRAS mutation, and then you progress to a P53 mutation. Classic mnemonic people use for this is a AK53. Okay, so APC gene mutation, KRAS mutation, P53 mutation, and then you progress from having an adenoma to having a full-blown colorectal carcinoma. Okay, so that's one very nice way to tie in that knowledge here. You're like, oh, wait, this person has a KRAS mutation, so they are not responding to cetuximab. Okay, the reason they're not responding to cetuximab is that even if you're blocking ERBB1, which is the epidermal growth factor receptor, you're not... the second messenger is already overactive, so you're basically screwed in that regard. Okay, so we're done with the C's. Let's jump to the D's. I've already talked about one of these D's, okay, denosumab. It's a monoclonal antibody against RANK ligand, okay? So you can use it to treat a very nasty hypercalcemia, because remember that RANK ligand is expressed by osteoblasts. It binds to the RANK receptor that's found on osteoclasts, which activates the RANK receptors, and then that causes your osteoclast to resorb your bone. So if you bound up RANK ligand with a dummy receptor like denosumab, okay, it's a monoclonal antibody, you bound it, bound up the RANK ligand, then you do not activate the osteoclast and you do not resorb bone. Alternatively, as an aside, if you want to bring in some more stuff here, there is a reason why women don't have bone problems until they are past menopause. The mechanism behind that is estrogen, which is a hormone that's found in women, right? Increases the synthesis of something known as osteoprotegrin. Osteoprotegrin is a binder, it's a dummy receptor for RANK ligand. Okay, so by binding up rank ligand, again, you don't have that rank ligand rank receptor interaction, so you don't activate osteoclast, so you do not resorb bone. Okay, so that that's another high yield tie-in there. Now the next D is a daclizumab. Daclizumab sort of works like basiliximab, if you may. It's a monoclonal antibody against the IL-2 receptor. Okay, more specifically CD25. Okay. Now the next D is Digibind. Digibind is the trade name, so you probably will never see this on a board exam. But the name you probably see on a board exam are the anti-DEG Fab fragments, anti-DEG Fab fragments. Okay, remember, you use this to rescue from digoxin toxicity. Now, we're done with the D's. Let's jump to the E's. The first E is eculizumab. Okay, eculizumab is a monoclonal antibody against C5. Okay, you use this to treat paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. Okay, remember, this is where you have a big A gene mutation, so you don't make GPI anchors. So things that are supposed to protect your red cells from complement-mediated damage, like CD55, which is also known as decay accelerating factor, or CD59, okay, they can hang out on your red cells, so complement goes nuts and destroys your red cells, okay? So you get a Coombs-negative hemolytic anemia, okay? So one way you can prevent this is by essentially preventing the membrane attack complex from forming, and you can do that by giving a monoclonal against C5 like eculizumab. And one nice way that your friends at the MBME can tie in eculizumab with microbiology is to sort of help you is to sort of put forward a question that asks about what you could do for a person after they get eculizumab as chronic therapy for PNH. One thing you can do is to actually give those people Neisseria vaccinations, okay? So like vaccines against Neisseria meningitis, because remember that people that have a C5 through C9 deficiency have an increased risk of recurrent Neisseria infections, okay? So by giving eculizumab, you're pharmacologically inducing C5 deficiency, if you may, okay? So those people need to be placed on Neisseria vaccines. Okay, so that's the first E. Next E is evolocumab. Evolocumab works like alirocumab. It's a PCSK9 inhibitor, so you can use that for hypercholesterolemia. The G, so there's no F, the G is golimumab. Golimumab is a monoclonal antibody against the TNF receptor, okay? Just like adalimumab, and even the next drug I'm going to talk about, infliximab, right? So it's an I. Infliximab is also a monoclonal against the TNF-alpha receptor. Now, the next I I'm going to talk about is idarucizumab. So idarucizumab is actually used to reverse dabigatran. In fact, in the hospital, this is known as Praxbind. It reverses Pradaxa. Pradaxa is the trade name for dabigatran. Okay, so in general, the common thinking was, oh, you can only reverse heparin and warfarin. Well, that's not exactly true anymore. You can actually reverse dabigatran, which is a direct thrombin inhibitor. It's a factor 2 inhibitor with idarucizumab. And you may say, Divine, this monoclonal sounds too low yield. I would encourage you to control F through your first aid for 2018 book, and you may be surprised. Okay, so next I. The next I is ipilimumab. Ipilimumab is basically used in immune therapy. It's a monoclonal antibody against CTLA-4. Okay, I would advise you to sort of look up that PD-L1 CTLA-4 business. It's actually kind of high yield to know for step one. I'll probably talk about it in a different podcast, but ipilimumab works against CTLA-4, and by working against CTLA-4, it prevents your cancer cells from telling your immune system to like keep quiet. So immune system like makes a lot of noise, and when your immune system makes noise, cancers melt away. Okay, so that's how ipilimumab works. It's a CTLA-4 inhibitor. Now we're done with the I's. Now let's jump to N. Okay, I don't believe there is an M monoclonal, so we'll jump to, at least that's necessary for step one. There's mepolizumab, but mepolizumab is not relevant to our discussion. So we'll jump to N. Okay, so the N we'll talk about is natalizumab. Natalizumab is used to treat multiple sclerosis. Okay, it's actually a monoclonal antibody against alpha-4 integrin. Okay, so by forming a monoclonal against alpha 4 integrin, remember that integrins mediate the adhesion step of your initial response to infection. Okay, so you can sort of imagine, like, if you form the monoclonal against that, your white cells that cause some of the damage in multiple sclerosis do not cross the blood-brain barrier and cause a lot of trouble. Okay, as an aside, please don't forget your integrin deficiency in leukocyte adhesion deficiency, right? So that's like a CD18 defect, where you have a delayed, the classic exam presentation is a delayed separation of the umbilical cord, or a person that has recurrent infections and they do not form a pus. Okay, so just something to keep in mind with integrins. Now, the next N I'll talk about is nivolumab. Okay, nivolumab is a monoclonal antibody against PD-1. Okay, it's a checkpoint inhibitor, just like ipilimumab, if you may. Okay, remember that PD-1, you actually find it on the surface of T cells. So PD-1 on the surface of T cells is bound by PD-1 ligand. Okay, PD-1 ligand is known as PD-L1. Whenever you have an interaction of PD-L1, which is classically expressed by cancer cells, with PD-1, which is found on the surfaces of T cells, it tells your immune system to shut up, okay, to not do anything to the cancer. Okay, so if you made a monoclonal against PD-1, okay, on the surface of T cells, even if a cancer cell is expressing PD-L1, that PD-L1 has no ability to bind the PD-1, so you don't tell your immune system, your T cells in this case, to shut up, so you can attack the cancer. Okay, so that's how nivolumab works. It's actually a blockbuster drug. It's not, I don't believe it's in first aid for the USMLE step 1 yet, but I'll be willing to put money on the fact that it will almost certainly make its way to some board exam soon. It's just a very high value drug, and those high value drugs, they usually love to introduce them as new drugs that you've probably like never heard anywhere on the board exams. Okay, now, we're done with the N's. Let's jump to the O's. Okay, the only O we'll talk about here is omalizumab. Omalizumab is a monoclonal antibody against the Fc region of IgE. Okay, the constant region of IgE. So you can actually use this to treat asthma. In fact, in kids that have like cystic fibrosis or they have like some kind of immune deficiency problem, if you sort of want to protect them against like asthma, as prophylaxis, you can actually place them on omalizumab. Although omalizumab can also just be used to prophylax against asthma, although it's a pretty expensive drug actually. Okay, now we'll jump to the P's. Okay, palivizumab. Palivizumab is a monoclonal antibody against the RSV. Okay, remember that you can actually use ribavirin to treat RSV as well, but that's very contentious. It's not very commonly done. Okay, but you can actually prophylax against or treat RSV by giving palivizumab, which is a monoclonal against the virus. Now, the next one I'll talk about, we're jumping to the R's. We have rituximab. It's a CD20 monoclonal antibody. Already talked about that. The next R is ranibizumab. Okay, ranibizumab sort of works like bevacizumab. It's just a super more expensive version. It's a monoclonal antibody against VEGF. Okay, you can also use this to treat wet age-related macular degeneration, which we already talked about. And then we jump to the T's. The T is trastuzumab. Trastuzumab is an ERB B2, or I guess you can call it HER2 new inhibitor. Remember that ERB B2 is very highly expressed in many breast cancers. Okay, so if you give a monoclonal antibody against that receptor, you could potentially stop that breast cancer in its tracks. Although, in general, the expression of ERB2 is a bad prognostic indicator in the setting of breast cancer. So, remember that this drug is trastuzumab is associated with a dilated cardiomyopathy. Okay, although the dilated cardiomyopathy with trastuzumab is usually reversible. When you stop the drug, the cardiomyopathy usually goes away. Okay, contrast that with your anthracyclines like Dono and doxorubicin that are associated with an irreversible dilated cardiomyopathy, okay, which arises because those drugs love to kill it iron, okay, and through the Fenton reaction, you can have destruction of your cardiac muscle, okay, so you could potentially prophylax against that if you're taking doxorubicin with an iron chelator like dextrozoxin, okay, so think of dextrozoxin as a Fenton reaction inhibitor, if you may. Okay, now the let's see. So let's jump to the U's. Okay. The U I'll talk about is ustekinumab. Ustekinumab is a monoclonal antibody against interleukin 12 and interleukin 23. It's actually used for the treatment of psoriasis. And the thinking there is that people think that, oh, psoriasis is thought to be due to like a cell-mediated immune response, okay? Remember that IL-12 helps you go down the T-helper-1 pathway, and T-helper-1 cells are involved in cell-mediated immunity. So by giving this drug, it would, could potentially stop the pathophysiology of psoriasis. And it also... ustekinumab also prevents T-helper-17 differentiation, because remember, T-helper-17 cells, they're involved in autoimmune disease, and to go from T-helper-0 to T-helper-17, you actually use interleukin-23 to make that happen. So by giving a monoclonal antibody against IL-23, you stop that from happening. Okay, now the final drug we'll talk about is an S, secukinumab. Secukinumab, it sort of works like ustekinumab, but I can see how they could potentially try to twist your brains with this on step one. Okay, so let's sort of break this down real quick. The thing is, if you want to go down the T-helper-17 route, remember those cells are involved in autoimmune disease like I mentioned, you need IL-23 to make that happen. Okay, now the thing is, T-helper-17 cells, for them to mediate all their badness, they actually release interleukin-17. Okay, so the thing is, you have two drug strategies for targeting T-helper-17 cells. Sorry, you can prevent their differentiation by giving a monoclonal against IL-23. That's the mechanism of action of ustekinumab. Alternatively, you can also make a monoclonal antibody against their cellular product, IL-17 in this case, with secukinumab. Secukinumab is a monoclonal antibody against the interleukin-17. Okay, now that we're done with the alphabet, let's just quickly wrap up by talking about the remaining immune system drugs. Okay, the remaining immune system drugs, right? So we already said that interleukin-2 is a powerful T-cell stimulator, okay? And one of the things you need to make transcribe the interleukin-2 gene is you need a transcription factor, okay? You need a transcription factor. And the thing is, the transcription factor for the IL-2 gene is NFAT, okay? NFAT, okay? It increases the rate of transcription of the IL-2 gene, okay? When NFAT is dephosphorylated, it is active. When NFAT is phosphorylated, it is inactive. Okay, now it so happens that calcineurin is an enzyme that dephosphorylates NFAT. Okay, and remember that dephosphorylated NFAT is active. Okay, and calcineurin is the phosphatase, if you may, that dephosphorylates NFAT. Okay, so if you inhibited calcineurin, you will prevent the dephosphorylation of NFAT. If you do not dephosphorylate NFAT, you do not increase the transcription of interleukin. You don't increase, or I guess you can say you do decrease the transcription of interleukin-2. Okay, so there are two classes of calcineurin inhibitors, right? You can use these drugs to clobber the immune system, right? So that you can prevent organ rejection, if you may. Okay, so one drug is a cyclosporin. Okay, cyclosporin, the way it works is it marries cyclophilin, and together they go ahead and inhibit a calcineurin. This drug has a few high yield things they want you to know for the USMLE step one exam. Okay, the big one you certainly want to know is nephrotoxicity. Okay, the thing is, cyclosporin causes vasoconstriction of the afferent and the efferent arterioles in the nephron. Okay, so that decreases your GFR. Okay, so you can basically have overactivation of your renin angiotensin aldosterone system, right? And that raises your blood pressure. So actually, hypertension is a very big side effect with cyclosporin, okay? And that's the, I've explained the mechanism behind the nephrotoxicity. There's also studies, or I guess some people that are saying that cyclosporin is like directly toxic to the nephron as well, like to your convoluted tubules. So that could be another potential mechanism behind the nephrotoxicity. But I'll say the big one you want to remember is causing vasoconstriction of your efferent and your afferent arterioles. And the thing is, cyclosporine is actually metabolized by your cytochrome P450 system. Okay, so the thing is, if you actually gave a CYP450 inhibitor, you could actually give a lower dose of cyclosporine. Okay, classically, the drug you actually use for this purpose is diltiazem. Remember, diltiazem is a is a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, right? So it's a class 4 antiarrhythmic. It so happens that DILT is a CYP450 inhibitor. So you may see, like, Divine, that's super awkward. Why are you giving DILT? I mean, there are many other drugs that reduce the activity of your, or I guess, inhibit your cytochrome P450 system. The reasoning behind that is, yes, DILT is a CYP450 inhibitor, right? So it lowers the dose of cyclosporine you need to give. But we just said that cyclosporine causes hypertension. Okay, diltiazem, I mean, it's sort of a weak effect, but it can also actually help you lower your blood pressure, okay, by opening up your renal vasculature. Okay, so just another high yield tie in there. Now, another high yield side effect of cyclosporine is gingival hyperplasia. Okay, if you look up pictures of this online, it's actually pretty disturbing, but it's just a side effect associated with cyclosporine. No one really knows why that's the case, okay? But you definitely want to know that concept for step one. And you also want to actually know the other drugs that are associated with gingival hyperplasia, right? So drugs like phenytoin, remember, phenytoin is a sodium channel blocker. That's an anti-seizure medication. Your calcium channel blockers, actually, both your dihydropyridine, like amlodipine, felodipine, nifedipine, and your non-dihydropyridine drugs like verapamil and diltiazem, they are also associated with gingival hyperplasia. Okay, and one bizarre thing, this will be a step one question that many people will miss, but hopefully you would not be one of them, because you listen to this podcast, or Pathoma, if you may, is that acute monocytic or monoblastic leukemia is actually also associated with gingival hyperplasia. Okay, so those are the high yield things with cyclosporine. Cyclosporine marries cyclophilin to inhibit calcineurin, causes nephrotoxicity, is broken down by CYP450, so you can give diltiazem to lower the dose of cyclosporine you need to administer, and it's also associated with a gingival hyperplasia. Okay, now the second class of calcineurin inhibitors includes a tacrolimus. Tacrolimus is also known as FK506. Okay, it's a calcineurin inhibitor, and the way it inhibits calcineurin is it marries a different person this time. Instead of marrying cyclophilin like cyclosporine does, it actually marries FKBP, okay, FK binding protein, okay, and together they inhibit calcineurin. Okay, the big toxicity you want to know with tacrolimus is that it's also nephrotoxic, but it's not as nephrotoxic as cyclosporine. Now, the next drug I'll talk about is meromonab. Okay, meromonab is also known as orthoclone T3 or OKT3. Okay, sort of sounds like a robotic or I guess an alien name, but anyhow. Okay, so it's an inhibitor of CD3. Okay, remember, CD3, you find it on the surface of all your T cells. Okay, so this is a drug that basically depletes your T cell population. Okay, remember, your T cells could have CD4, CD8. They also have like the T cell receptor, which has an alpha and a beta chain. So this drug, by binding to CD3, it basically clobbers your T cell numbers. But one thing I will just draw your attention to is this drug usually, or I guess you can say occasionally, okay, by initially binding to CD3, it actually causes an initial activation of CD3. Okay, so initially you can actually have T cell activation with meromonab. Okay, in fact, this side effect is called the first dose activation effect. Okay, so initially you actually activate your T cell population, you release a lot of cytokines, and you can become like hypotensive. You can have like a flu like reaction that could actually be pretty severe. Okay, but as time goes on, that inflammatory response decreases. Okay, and your T cell population is depleted. In fact, OKT3 meromonab is classically used like in the immediate period after a transplant to prevent acute rejection, because it's actually really, really good at bringing down your T cell population. Okay, now the next drug I'll talk about is mycophenolate mofetil. I believe this is known as Cellcept in the hospital. It's an inosine monophosphate dehydrogenase inhibitor. Okay. Remember, if you're going from IMP to GMP, you need IMP dehydrogenase to make that happen. Okay, so by inhibiting IMP dehydrogenase, you basically decrease the synthesis of purines because you're making less guanine nucleotides. Okay, so that's how this drug works as an immunosuppressant. Remember that ribavirin, which we use to treat RSV and also Hep B and C, also works by inhibiting IMP dehydrogenase. Now, the next drug I'll talk about is sirolimus. It's also known as rapamycin. Okay, sirolimus binds to the same protein that tacrolimus binds to. Okay, so sirolimus binds to FK binding protein. Okay, but it does not inhibit calcineurin. It inhibits mTOR. Okay, mTOR stands for mammalian target of rapamycin. Okay, so remember that mTOR is a signaling molecule that is downstream of the interleukin 2 receptor. So you're basically making a T cell not respond to IL-2 signaling. So one way you can do that, we already mentioned, is you could block the IL-2 receptor with drugs like daclizumab and basiliximab. Alternatively, you can kill the IL-2 signaling cascade by inhibiting mTOR with a drug like sirolimus. So so you can use sirolimus to prevent a rejection of a transplant. Alternatively, if you're an interventional cardiologist, or I guess if you're a med student listening to this, you're a future interventional cardiologist, you actually coat stents that you put in coronary arteries with these drugs, because by preventing T-cell proliferation, you do not form like scar tissue, right? You don't make your immune system think of the stent as a foreign molecule, okay? So to prevent like stenosis of a stent, okay, you can actually coat those stents with everolimus or sirolimus, right? So they are like similar drugs. They accomplish the same purpose. Now, the last drug I'll talk about is antithymocyte globulin. Okay, antithymocyte globulin, its mechanism of action is it basically binds to T cells. Okay, it's an immunoglobulin. The thing is, the constant region of antithymocyte globulin can be recognized by receptors on the surface of macrophages. Okay, so basically, your macrophages, when they bind to this constant region, they can basically swallow up your T cells that way. Okay, so this is sort of like an opsonizing mechanism, if you may, and you basically deplete your T cell population by doing that. As an aside, please don't forget that IgG is the only antibody that can do opsonization. Okay, C3b is also a complement protein that can do opsonization, but remember that IgG and IgM can both do classic complement cascade activation. Okay, and this antithymocyte globulin is actually derived from animals. So you can actually get serum sickness with this drug. Okay, remember, serum sickness is a kind of type 3 hypersensitivity reaction. So this brings us to the end of immunopharmacology. I believe if you know everything in this podcast, you know all the immunopharmacology you need to know for basically your USMLE exams, both step 1 and step 2 CK, and you should also know all your monoclonal antibodies for the exams with the drugs we talked about in the monoclonal alphabet. So I wish you all the best. Happy Easter to those that celebrate Easter, and I wish you all a wonderful week ahead. Have a great day, and God bless you. I'll see you in the next podcast. Thank you.